Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about the true story. On this podcast, we touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. We'll also hear about the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. Today, we're talking about a film both directed by and starring Ben Affleck. This is the movie Argo, about the rescue of six American embassy workers who are trapped in Iran during the 1979 revolution and subsequent hostage crisis. It's a pretty heavy subject, but the film tries to balance the tense hostage crisis with the fun Hollywood side of this story. We should also note this is the first film Affleck directed that did not take place in Boston.
Critics and moviegoers alike loved this movie. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 3, including Best Picture in 2012.
I was just going to say, we should pause here for a moment to consider the fact that of all the movies we've discussed on this podcast, Argo is the only one that has won Best Picture, which if you laid out The Social Network, Zodiac, and Goodfellas, and Argo, and said, which one of these should get Best Picture? I don't know that Argo would be the one I would choose. What do you think, Joanna?
It's almost like you're saying the Best Picture Oscar does not go to the actual Best Picture of that year.
I'm saying on an extremely rare occasion that may occur.
It's true. Sometimes it does happen. Let me name a few films that were nominated for Best Picture that came out the year that Argo won in 2013. Django Unchained, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Silver Linings Playbook, Zero Dark Thirty. There's a few more, but those are all the ones I'm going to mention. Beast of the Southern Wild, sure. Let's throw that in there. Of those, I guess I would say, what, Lincoln? This is a funky year. The Master came out that year, but it wasn't nominated. I would give it to The Master. That's what I'd give it to.
Yeah. I see what you're saying now. It's not like any of those movies is like immediate. Like everyone would agree that that's right. The one that should win.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is probably was in Argo's favor.
Right. Exactly. The Academy of Motion Pictures loves awarding Oscars to films that are about the art of filmmaking. And Argo, I was just tweeting about this the other day while I was watching this. Argo is like the doozy of this because it's not like filmmaking is important, like, you know, the artist won, I think, the previous year and stuff like that. You know, it's like film industry, including like a B-movie makeup guy. And a, like, you know, a slightly he's not sleazy, but, you know, whatever, producer.
Over the hill movie
yeah,
producer,
sure.
Yeah.
Saved the lives of 6 trapped Americans. You know what I mean? Like, this is the ultimate, like, the movies matter sort of movie. So,
and I think the only other one that comes to mind that's like that is Inglourious Basterds, the Quentin Tarantino movie, in which film literally helps to end the Second World War.
Sure, but that's like an alternative history, whereas this is like, yeah. This actually happens.
Yeah.
Anyway, so controversially that year, 2013, Affleck didn't get a nomination for director or actor. This was like a big controversy, and it was seen as like the Directors Guild being prejudiced against an actor turned director. And a lot of people think that Affleck being snubbed is the reason why the film won Best Picture. That's a whole, we can get deep on that. I do another podcast about award season. We don't need to talk about that here. But anyway, Affleck won Best Director at the Golden Globes. The film won for Best Drama at the Golden Globes. It also won a lot of other awards at film festivals and Guild Award ceremonies.
But the film also received a lot of criticism for emphasizing the CIA's role in this rescue mission, when in fact, Canada had a very big hand in planning it and protecting the diplomats. And before the CIA's involvement was declassified, the CBC made a film about it in 1981 called The Canadian Caper. So let's talk about the movie. It stars Ben Affleck as CIA exfiltrator Tony Mendez, Bryan Cranston as his boss Jack O'Donnell, John Goodman as Hollywood makeup artist John Chambers, Alan Arkin as film producer Lester Siegel, and Victor Garber as Canadian ambassador Ken Taylor, who's one of the heroes of this film.
Victor Garber wears the most incredible pair of glasses throughout this movie. I just want to put that on record. Okay.
Great, great glasses acting in this film.
Ben Affleck wanted very much for this film to feel like a 1970s Hollywood movie, so it opens with the old Warner Brothers logo, and it starts with a storyboard depiction of the Iranian Revolution of 1979. The gist, as the film lays out, is that the Shah ruled Iran, but that people didn't like him. He was opulent. He let his people starve. And it was when he started to westernize Iran that people had enough and overthrew him, and he was exiled. The Ayatollah Khomeini came in his place as a popular leader. The Shah asked for asylum in the United States to be treated for cancer. And when he was admitted, Iranian students started to protest outside of the U.S. embassy. This is an incredibly complicated political events. Any number of people you could ask will tell you a different version of this story in terms of like who the United States is propping up as a leader in that country, or like who was actually popular in Iran at the time. But this is sort of the narrative of events as the film itself lays it out.
Yeah. So the film kind of extremely simplifies the facts. And we're a podcast that's covering the film, so we're simplifying what's in the film. So just know that like this is an extremely kind of simplified version of events, and like we don't think that our podcast, at least this episode, is going to cover the complexities of our relationship with Iran and the history of that. But what we can talk about is the film itself. And I do just want to ask, you know, about this opening. It's designed to look like film storyboards, and it matches the style of the illustration of storyboards that we see later in the film. I actually really appreciated this. I mean, first of all, I just like whenever a movie does this kind of meta commentary on itself, of showing you like, hey, this is how we're making the thing that you're watching. I always enjoy that kind of thing. I understand if other people find it tiresome, though. But the kind of point that I got from this is that any reality that we see on a movie screen is ultimately like a constructed reality, right? I think that doesn't really fit in with the broader themes of the movie, but it, you know, in that like you can't really know if what you're seeing is real, but like that's the impression I got, is that hey, what you're seeing, like you should not necessarily trust anything you're seeing, even in this movie that you're watching right now, because like somebody has like meticulously planned out every shot, every camera movement, every framing, and so on. So I thought it was really a thought-provoking introduction, even though it does simplify this story fairly cleanly into like, these are the good people, these are the bad people overall. What do you think, Joanna?
Yeah, on the one hand, but I do think it leaves a little room in the beginning for this idea that like the Shah was a US-backed leader who was very interested in westernizing Iran, and that there are good things that come with that and there are bad things that come with that. And what's complicated about the Ayatollah Khomeini, I mean, there's many things that are complicated, but the fact he sort of made the case for his leadership based on a lot of ideals that he immediately did not follow through on. And I'm not even talking about like low-key campaign promises. I'm talking about he's like, women deserve equal treatment in Iran. And then he instituted very strict anti-feminist laws in Iran. And so it's very complicated. But this is why you'll see a lot of women in and among the student revolutionaries, because they believed the Ayatollah Khomeini was there to promote female equality in Iran. And that turned out to not be the case, depending on your definition of female equality. So, you know, it's incredibly complicated. The question for Argo overall, and we touched upon this already, is how to balance the sort of lighthearted comedy of the Hollywood farce with this like incredibly serious and upsetting, you know, political moment, like the Iran hostage crisis, which went on for over, like it's interesting to think of these. We care about these six hostages. We care about the story about how getting them out of Iran. Meanwhile, there's all these people who are held hostage in the embassy, and then they spread them out all over the country in like dire circumstances for over a year. And that's like, I'm like, what's that story?
What is that story? Right.
It's a tricky thing to try to handle in such a zippy way. And in some ways the film succeeds, in some ways it doesn't, I think. So,
yeah, but it's fascinating. You obviously need the six characters, or else the film, it would be a lot harder for the film to function, right? Because you wouldn't get to know any of these people. You wouldn't get to identify any characteristics with them if there were hundreds or dozens that you needed to try to relate to. But the overall impact is you're basically looking at a piece of paper through a straw. You know what I mean? Like you're getting a tiny snapshot of what this entire situation is, and a pretty like simplified snapshot. Like even the snapshot itself is pretty simplified, and like the good guys and the bad guys, it feels overall pretty clear. Like, these people are innocent. These other people want to hurt them. We got to get them to safety. That's essentially kind of the conflict of the movie. In real life, I suspect it's much more complicated.
Right. So after we get this, like, you know, laying of groundwork of the political context of where we are in Iran at this time, the film opens with the riots outside of the embassy and people are burning the American flags and trying to break in. And we see from some images that play at the end of the film that a lot of these shots are taken sort of, you know, frame by frame from the actual coverage of the riots at the time. So Affleck here did a very faithful adaptation of what the crowd was like climbing over the gates and stuff like that. There are a lot of people in the scenes, like several hundred. They're filling the streets outside. They're holding signs, pictures of the Ayatollah. Some of the footage here is grainier, but none of the footage that like looks like it might be archive footage is actually archive footage. The director of photography, Rodrigo Prieto, gave some extras 8mm cameras so they would have realistic looking riot footage, which I think is a brilliant idea and really lends to the chaos and tumult of the scene itself.
So at the embassy, we see the stark contrast of the packed in crowd pressing up against the gate of the embassy's empty parking lot. Inside, the embassy itself is library quiet, and two employees at the embassy who'll become part of the six refugees. We got Mark Lijek, who's played by Christopher Denham, and we've got Bob Anders, who's played by Tate Donovan. They're talking about how the crowd outside is bigger than usual, but they don't seem too worried, and they go about their business like it's a totally normal day. This implies that the protests have been going on for a while, and in fact, they had. In this next clip, Bob Anders himself talks about how this kind of thing had been pretty normalized.
Things were pretty chaotic, and things were not very well organized, really. And there were many different subgroups who were not necessarily cooperating with one another. So the day of the takeover was just like any other day, and there was a demonstration, but we really didn't pay too much attention to it. The demonstrations had gotten a little more lively in the last couple of weeks because the Shah had left Iran 1st of January 1979.
And then the riots start to escalate, and some of the protesters actually manage to get over the fence, which makes some of the security guards inside nervous. And finally, the protesters cut the chain. They have a bolt cutter and storm the parking lot to the embassy building. In real life, the protesters were mostly students and idealist groups, not militants, but they had planned ahead. They had been staking out the area to plan an attack. We'll hear from a pair of journalists about this. We've got Robin Wright, and we also have Matt Baglio. Baglio co-wrote the book about Argo with Tony Mendez, the character played by Ben Affleck. First, you'll hear Wright, followed by Baglio.
They knew where everything was. They knew where the gate was, what kind of iron that it was made of in order to cut the fence. And they knew particularly that there was one window in the chancery that was a fire exit that was particularly vulnerable, and that was the first place they went. They had armbands. They had headbands. They put women first in part because they thought there wouldn't be any desire to shoot at women. They had stencils of Ayatollah Khomeini because they thought if anyone was shot by the Americans, that the propaganda value of showing a picture of a bullet wound that had gone through a picture of Ayatollah Khomeini would have tremendous impact.
When the Iranians surrounded the chancery, they knew that there was this one weak spot, and this was this basement window that had been left really unbarred. Millions of dollars had been spent to try to make it secure. They had glass windows, a steel door on the second floor. But they left this one window sort of unprotected. And the Iranians knew that. And they went right there, they broke the window, and they were able to enter into the basement. And this startled the Americans. It caught them off guard.
Wright also said that the students' intention was to stage a sit-in, but things escalated very quickly. We do see the students break through that window in the basement. Inside the embassy, the guards immediately spring into action, calling in the Marines to fall back. People are burning files and shredding papers to eliminate all important information and prevent it from being discovered. We now meet two more of the six diplomats, Kathy, played by Carrie Bechet, and her husband, Joe Stafford, played by Scoot McNairy. They ask if they can wait a little longer to see what will happen, but other people are saying they need to leave immediately. The Marines are told to use tear gas as a last resort, but tear gas is fired. And this also really happened and was part of why everything escalated so quickly.
Okay, and then the security chief, and this also actually happened, decided he wanted to go outside. Why? His plan does not work. He gets attacked, blindfolded, and is now used as leverage for the students to get inside. So they pour inside, thanks security chief, and all the employees and anyone inside the building is rounded up and blindfolded. One of the rebels finds a photo inside the embassy of the Ayatollah with darts in it and gets very upset. It's chaos. Meanwhile, the six diplomats that we're going to follow for the rest of the film, and maybe a few more people, walk out the back door. Very casually, no one even notices. And believe it or not, this is more or less how it actually happened. It's not clear from the film that the people who escaped were in a different building than the one that was stormed. A building called the Chancery was stormed, and behind that was the consulate. All the people who were actually in the consulate were able to leave the building, and a lot of Iranians who had come in that day to get visas or passports actually ended up going home. Mark Lijek, one of the six, describes the scene when they finally got outside.
When we initially left the compound, I was scared for a variety of reasons. I mean, if we were caught, we would be grabbed, probably roughed up, dragged back into the compound, and collected with the other Americans that they'd managed to round up at this point. I didn't want that to happen, so I was on the alert to see who was there, and I was hoping, praying that they hadn't realized that we were trying to exit the building and that there wouldn't be people there. I mean, the way the compound's laid out, there's a street that runs right along the west wall, and that street connects the point where they entered the compound, the motor pool gate, to our little back square where our visa applicants gather. And so that was the danger point, I thought, is crossing the mouth of that street, because I didn't know how far along it the demonstrators had gotten. And I was relieved, frankly, to see that the street was really congested with vehicles and people. But some of the people in our group were visa officers who had been seen by a lot of Iranians. And it was a long shot, but a possibility somebody would recognize one of them. My wife, for example, did that kind of work.
There was an immediate danger of recognition, and in fact, a few other people who had escaped with them later got recaptured.
Meanwhile, at the State Department, the government is discussing the situation. They know there are hostages at the embassy, but six people have escaped. For now, it's all hands on deck. The State Department, the White House, the CIA are all involved. And for now, they decide to leave the six where they are, which is at the Canadian embassy with Victor Garber. In reality, the six of them didn't just go to the Canadian embassy, end of story. Five of them actually spent about a week going from place to place trying to find somewhere safe, and the sixth one, Lee Schatz, who is the guy with the magnificent mustache, played by Rory Cochrane, spent a couple of days sleeping on the floor of the Swedish embassy before meeting up with everyone at the Canadians. Here's Mark Lijek, Bob Anders, and journalist Matt Baglio telling some of the stories from the places they stayed. First, here's Mark.
The consul general was in his office. He came out into the hallway, and he said, we're supposed to try to go to the British Embassy. But just as Joe was on the phone to the number two at the British Embassy, he says, the bastards are coming over the walls, and hangs up on Joe.
So the British Embassy was being overrun. Bob Anders describes their next step.
This residence, I think it was John Graves' residence, who was a public affairs officer, was in a part of town that none of us knew anything about or not familiar with. And the Thai cook, as I understand it, with his wife and his mother-in-law, as that was my understanding, they were also in the residence, in this residence, and they were back in the kitchen, and they were frequently arguing and shouting. But every now and then, Sam would come to us and say, well, don't worry about it. My mother-in-law is getting nervous or excited, but it's okay, don't worry. But of course, it was worrisome. Because, you know, if anything had happened, if we were all discovered, they would have been in serious trouble.
Rather than risk it with the chef's mother-in-law, they moved on. Here's journalist Matt Bagley.
They go down the street to a woman's house, Katie Coob, who worked in the IAS. So they go to her house, and they're thinking this could be the next place that we stay. They're literally going from house to house to house. But when they get to Katie Coob's house, they realize it's just not going to work. It's right on the street. There's no way they can hide. The window, there's a massive window leading from, you know, in, from one living room into the kitchen. They couldn't even go into the kitchen without being spotted from the street.
And finally, they ended up at the Canadian embassy. Here's Bob Anders with how they got there.
Fortunately, one of the items I put in my briefcase when I left my apartment was my local address and phone book, which was the key to our next move. So then I called John Sheridan, and I remember very clearly the first thing he said, "Why didn't you call sooner?"
Yeah, John Sheridan. Let's talk about that and get it out of the way. The house where four of the six of them stayed was the house of Canadian Ambassador John Sheridan and his wife Zina, neither of whom are in the movie. Two of them stayed with Ken Taylor, who's played by Victor Garber, as well as his wife, Pat, who's played by Paige Leong. But the Sheridans were really given the short straw with this film. A Slate article by David Haglund that came out after the film has more details on how much Canada really did for this mission. I'll just quote from the article here. Quote, 30 years ago, Canada received complete credit for the rescue because the U.S. was worried about possible repercussions if the CIA involvement was publicized. Argo corrects that version of events, or rather overcorrects it, downplaying the actual extent of Canadian involvement, which was considerable. The Americans were housed by two Canadians, Ken Taylor and John Sheridan. According to an article at beachmetro.com, the Canadians scouted the airport, sent people in and out of Iran to establish random patterns and get copies of entry and exit visas, bought three sets of airline tickets, even coached the six in sounding Canadian.
I would have watched that film.
If this was a miniseries, there'd be a whole episode about how to sound Canadian.
Oh, I love it.
But yeah, to finish this excerpt from the article, almost none of that appears in Argo. Taylor himself has a major part and is presented as a sympathetic and brave man who took great personal risk to save the Americans, but his actual role was even larger. He was spying for the U.S. throughout the hostage crisis at the request of Jimmy Carter. After some friends who attended the Argo premiere in Toronto described it to Taylor, he expressed concern that we're being portrayed as innkeepers who are waiting to be saved by the CIA, end quote. Which is a pretty fair description of what the film depicts. So just want to clear that up. Like, that's probably the biggest crime against reality that this movie commits, is like downplaying what the Canadians did. In fact, you know, everyone did a great job in executing this plan, U.S. people and Canadians. But really, the Canadians did a lot that was excised from the film.
Well, especially since this film is, you know, from time to time, like fist-pumpingly, jingoistically American.
Yeah.
It really, I think, would have helped temper that to involve the Canadians a bit more.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And not to mention the fact that Victor Garber, Morgan Victor Garber, is better as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Mm. So back to the movie that Ben Affleck made. 69 days later, we see yellow ribbons all around DC and meet our main character, Tony Mendez, as played by Ben Affleck. We hear that 50 Americans are being held hostage. That number is more or less accurate. And we learn that Tony's job is a CIA exfiltrator. But they won't let him exfiltrate the hostages. What good is an exfiltrator if he can't exfiltrate? At a retirement party, Tony hangs out in the bathroom, gloomy. His boss is played by Bryan Cranston. The character's name is Jack O'Donnell, but he's a composite character. And he comes in to give Tony a pep talk and a drink. We learn very early on that this character, Jack O'Donnell, is always going to be on Tony's side and support him absolutely. We also learn that Tony is either in the middle of getting a divorce or is a trial separation from his wife, Christine, played by Orange Is the New Black's Taylor Schilling. What do you make of Cranston in this film? I feel like, you know, Zero Dark Thirty came out the same year, and I feel like this was a time when we saw just like a lot of great TV actors, maybe specifically Kyle Chandler, and we'll talk about that more later, playing these like government bureaucrats, like desk jockey sort of characters. Like, what do you make of Cranston in this film, Dave?
Yeah, he's good. I mean, he's someone you want on your side, and he seems like fundamentally a good person who's trying to do the right thing, but is trapped in a challenging system. And I think that's one of the roles that Bryan Cranston does best. you know? And so I like him in this movie. But he does definitely get the chance to do a lot of yelling about doing the right thing and back Ben Affleck's character up in big and important ways. So I was a fan.
The cast is really stacked in this way. We've got like Chris Messina, Zelcho Ivanek, Titus Welliver, Kyle Chandler as various like members of the government. Kyle Chandler playing the White House Chief of Staff, Hamilton Jordan, Richard Kine. These are all like character actors who I recognize. Cranston and Chandler obviously being like the most recognizable. But it's just so interesting to me that they cast this government so well for like these roles that, other than I would argue Messina, Cranston, and Chandler, like don't really land in any significant way. Maybe if they were playing Canadians, I would care more. I don't know, but but that's the state of the U.S. government affairs there.
Well, I'm sorry that the government bureaucrats weren't very memorable, Joanna. that's a bummer, but I like them. I like them. Back to the movie. On the news, we hear about how the hostage negotiations are going, and Tony is either living in a hotel room with boxes or he just moved out. It's an indication of how his personal life is not going so great, and I think we'll discuss this a little bit more later, but we should point out that like this whole thing about him being in the middle of this separation or divorce is completely fabricated for the film. It's just to give him this character arc during the course of the movie, because you know, when you solve a huge problem or save the day, it also means you have to grow as a person, right? It is curious.
I don't hate that.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Zero Dark Thirty, and that's a movie where you have a government badass, but I feel like you know very, very little about that person's life. Did you see Zero Dark Thirty by any chance?
I did.
Yeah, and you know very little about Jessica Chastain's character's life, right? Like, you get tiny glimpses of it. And I feel like it's just like, you know what? We don't need to, you know, consider any of this stuff. We're just trying to tell this story of this specific thing that happened. And whether or not that, you know, the truth of that, we can put that aside. But like, it's a very different approach, I feel, to what this movie takes, which is that, hey, it's important that you are connected. Like, you need to be emotionally connected with what Tony Mendez is doing. And to do that, we're going to make him have a troubled marriage, which, I don't know, I felt is a little bit cliche, a little bit simple, and is not even based in reality. But why did it work for you, Jonah?
When I was watching this, and this is with the benefit of hindsight, knowing that Ben Affleck and his wife Jennifer Garner split in 2015, officially divorced in 2018, that he has a bunch of kids with her, that he was probably like separated from his kids a lot on film shoots and stuff like that. Like, I don't mean to be overly empathetic to the very rich, successful Hollywood movie star. But if there is some sort of personal story for him in this, in terms of being separated from his children or estranged from his wife at all, leading up to his eventual divorce, and he put that in the story, I don't hate that. You know what I mean? Because like, it gives him, I think those scenes with his son over the phone and stuff like that, like I really love the scene where he's like calls his son. He's like, what are we watching? Turns into Planet of the Apes or whatever. Like, I just think that there's like a real, that scene more than a lot of the rest of the film actually feels true. And I think it's because Ben Affleck was sort of, I don't mean to like over hypothesize here, but like, I would guess that maybe he was reacting emotionally to his own life experience and how it related to that. And for that reason, it kind of works for me. I don't know about the end where he's like happily welcomed back into the nest sort of thing. I don't know if that's necessarily, but like his relationship and estrangement from his son, I found compelling.
Yeah, I think I can agree with you there. I think like his whole thing with Taylor Schilling's character didn't quite work for me, but the relationship with the son, you can definitely feel like there's some authenticity there. So agreed, yeah. So anyway, he gets a phone call in this movie, and he runs back to CIA headquarters. Jack explains that the Canadians can't hold their six people forever, and President Carter wants them exfiltrated. The main issue is that now Iranians are working to put the shredded documents back together to find information on the people working there. According to the CIA, they were actually skilled carpet weavers, although in the movie they're depicted more like children or sweatshop workers. But anyway, if they're not fast enough, The identities of the people would be compromised and they would likely be executed, as an example. So the immediate danger of the six hidden Americans is largely exaggerated in the film for added tension. Yes, if they were spotted on the street, it's possible someone would recognize them as an American and be suspicious, but no one was actively looking for these exact six people who had escaped the Iranian embassy.
Meanwhile, in the CIA meeting room, we get the breakdown about who the six diplomats sheltering with the Canadians are. So we have Cora and Matt Leitchek, one married couple, Lee Schatz, Joe and Kathy Stafford, another married couple, and Bob Anders. Something that I thought was interesting that they mentioned is that they were sort of thirsty for staffers at this consulate. And so the wives were given like jobs in like the typing pool or whatever to sort of help with their staffing issues. That's why we have two married couples working together here. Whoever's running the meeting suggests they ride bikes to safety because the streets are too congested for car, but they don't know who can ride bikes. Tony is a little skeptical of this really, really clever plan. So he thinks quick and names all the problems that they're facing. They can't use the airport or real names. The room comes up with a couple ideas for cover stories. They're teachers, agricultural surveyors, missionaries, and Tony shoots down all of these ideas. Why would teachers be going into a war zone? Iran absolutely wouldn't be welcoming to missionaries. And there's snow on the ground, so there wouldn't be any crops. And these are some of the ideas that they eventually present to the six diplomats. But in the end, we see they didn't go for any of them.
Yeah, so a couple thoughts on this scene. First of all, I just gotta say, John Robinson, no matter how many times I see a scene of, you know, young upstart rogue wunderkind going into a room of bureaucrats and just telling them how they're all wrong, I just can't get enough of it. You know, I'm just a fan of that kind of scene. We talked about Zero Dark Thirty earlier. You know,
are we calling Tony Mendez a young upstart?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay,
he's got
some salt and pepper in his hair, and he's very experienced at this point. To me, it was more like the like dummies in the room who aren't like necessarily established bureaucrats. They're just sort of like, well, we've got these ideas. And Tony Mendez is like, I'm an exfiltrator. It's all I do.
Yeah. I mean,
ride bikes to freedom. Yeah.
It's a really effective scene. And it's great because it's kind of like, the way he talks to these people, it's kind of like making you realize like, oh yeah, this, like when you hear the ideas, you think they're stupid. Right. And so when he says why they're dumb, it kind of confirms your suspicions.
Yeah. It's not just that. I think we also needed to hear some of these ideas before we get on board with his stupid idea, which also sounds like crazy and stupid. But I think we need to hear like bike to safety first before we're like, yeah, fake movie. Great idea. Love it. So it also establishes Affleck's character. You know, like Tony Mendez was incredibly good at his job, but it quickly and comedically gives us, you know, that insight that this is a guy who really knows what he's doing. Even if like the low bar on the ground is let's not propose biking to safety in Iran, you know.
Indeed. Anyway, back to the movie. Cut to revolutionaries on television making demands. They say if the U.S. tries to use military force, they'll blow up the embassy. Meanwhile, at Ken Taylor's house, the six diplomats are having dinner and trying to figure out what they're going to do. A helicopter appears. They have to drop everything and get into a crawl space on the floor. The helicopter incident is also based on fact, although the copter didn't end up having anything to do with them. Bob Anders and Mark Leitchek tell the story. First, you're going to hear from Bob, and then Mark.
So I did not like being cooped up, so I would go out into this courtyard, and I'd do some fairly active or strenuous exercises for an hour or two. I would take a little sun bath if I could. So one day in doing this, a helicopter was I noticed flying over the area.
We were paranoid enough to think that this could be some way they were searching for us. Zena tried to call John at the embassy, and of course he knew nothing about it. But later he reported that a mullah had been assassinated in the neighborhood, and we assumed that the helicopter was looking for the assassins who had escaped on a motorcycle. Because when you think about it, a helicopter is not a very practical way to look for people hiding in the house.
This actually leads to a couple questions that I had when watching the film. These diplomats were in the house for over 2 months. Like, what do you do trapped inside for over 2 months? Who are these diplomats, really? We don't get to know them or any insights into their personality until Tony meets up with them later. The short answer is that they didn't do a heck of a lot. They watched the news when they could. They read a lot. They played Scrabble and they had dinner parties. Mark Lejek has a good metaphor for it.
The analogy that I like to use was, I felt like we were on the Titanic and that we didn't know when we were going to hit the iceberg. But unlike the people in the real Titanic, we knew that there were icebergs out there and that it was potentially possible that any day we could run into one. But meantime, we were going to still have those nice parties and fancy dinners and stuff like they did on the boat.
John Robinson, it's time for personal question time. And that is, what is the longest you think you could have a house guest?
Do I have a crawl space that I can tell them to just go into at any given time?
I just think like having a house guest for more than a week, you start to really start to kind of bump into each other in terms of your daily routines. And then these people were in there for what, months on end? I cannot imagine what it would be like to host six people for months. You know, that just... it just feels like there would be a lot of tension, and we do see some of that in the movie itself.
I have a couple follow-up points. First of all, it depends how big my Canadian diplomat house is, right?
Yep.
Secondly, I have staff to help with the cleanup, so that's nice. Yep. Thirdly, I'm Canadian, so I'm extremely polite and kind. Mm. So, you know, these are all factors working in Ken Taylor's favor, right?
Agreed. So.
Plus, they were spread out at least over two houses, even though the film doesn't make it seem that way. So we cut to a montage of American citizens reacting to what's going on in Iran, saying we should just nuke them. This scene is especially uncomfortable to watch right now in 2020.
Cut to January 16th, 1980. It's now 72 days since the hostage crisis began. We see a small child answer a phone. It's Tony's kid. And Tony and his son watch Planet of the Apes together. Something about the costumes in the desert gives him an idea. So at another CIA meeting, they're still trying to figure out an exfiltration plan, and Tony explains his idea. They'll be Canadian film producers. Because who else would be crazy enough to go out into a war zone? Tony has a connection in Hollywood, John Chambers, a prosthetics and makeup artist, who can hook them up with costumes. And I just want to pause here for a moment and say, like, the fact that they came up with the idea of producers is actually pretty hilarious, because they basically were thinking to themselves, who would be oblivious enough to want to go into this extremely fraught, you know, tense area? And they thought, like, movie producers, of course, like, they don't even care about what's happening in the world. They're so self-absorbed. All they care about is the movie. So it's pretty hilarious that this movie is about how producers in some way can be very oblivious to world events.
Yes. This movie has a lot of fun poking fun at Hollywood tapes. You know what I mean? Like, oh no, that's your screenwriter right there. Oh, that's your director, sort of thing. Anyway, all right.
I was just gonna say my favorite line is one that John Goodman says, where he says, you know, what do you want to be? And he's like, I want to be a producer. And he's like, you would be associate producer at best. It's just a great put down.
Yeah, great line. Great line. So back in Iran, the revolutionary is ramping up. The six diplomats are freaking out in the house. They have some serious cabin fever. And one of them, Tate Donovan's Bob Anders, tries to take a little trip outside. But other people spot, like, the other diplomats spot him and they freak out. And they're like, you can't even step outside for a breath of fresh air, Bob. So Tony is shown making a fake Russian passport, which gives us an indication that he's a skilled forger, might come in handy in exfiltrating. And he gets the news that his plan is approved. So he flies out to LA. Cut to Hollywood, where, oh my goodness, the Hollywood sign is a mess. For younger listeners, the original Hollywood sign, which said Hollywood Land, fell into disrepair in the 70s, and a few prominent millionaires each donated a letter to restore it back to say Hollywood. So it would have been repaired by now, but I guess it sets the tone for Hollywood being a decrepit place. I do love the side-by-side at the end, where they're like, see, the Hollywood sign really did look
really
like
that. It really was that way.
It's so funny. because it's like the Iranian Revolution, like horrible visions of like flag burnings and people dying and like blah, blah, blah. And also the Hollywood side.
Those are totally comparable tragedies. Don't you understand?
All on the same level. Absolutely.
So we see a cheesy sci-fi movie being filmed with over-the-top costumes. Sitting nearby is the costume designer, John Chambers, played by John Goodman. Tony's flown in, they go back to his trailer to talk. Tony reveals his plan, and John agrees to help him put together a fake production company. They give each of the six diplomats a production role, from photographer to screenwriter, but they need someone respectable to put on as the producer credit. So they go see Lester Siegel, played by a delightful Alan Arkin. Siegel is a composite character, kind of a caricature of an old-school Hollywood producer. In real life, they use Chambers' friend and fellow makeup artist Robert Seidel.
Okay, quick side note, by the way. So, like, John Chambers, who's this makeup artist, they say a couple times that he and Tony have worked together before. In the end credits, we find out that he, you know, received a medal, the highest honor the CIA could confer upon a civilian. I want the John Chambers movie. Like, what else did this makeup artist do for the government, for all their secret missions? I would like to know. You know, maybe we'll make that movie next. But meanwhile, back in Iran, the six diplomats are playing chess and washing dishes. They're very bored. We also get a bit of drama with a maid, Sahar, played by Sheila Vand. She's keeping the secrets for Ken Taylor, but will she keep it forever? This is a bit of tension that, like, actually kind of bugs me in the movie. But they felt the need in the script to dial up the tension wherever they could, because the true story of six people who stayed inside until Tony Menace showed up is like kind of boring. So
until a guy drove them to the airport, yeah, exactly. Basically.
Until a guy picked,
is the real
yeah,
story.
Six people stayed inside until a guy showed up and drove them to the airport. That's literally the story, anyway.
Yeah, but here's the thing with the Sahar character. I've been thinking about this. Right, is like, I feel like she is there to basically offer this movie's version of a balanced depiction of Iranians.
Yeah.
You know, because the vast majority of Iranians you see in this movie are like threatening people and killing people and, you know, chanting things, burning things. And I think this movie does not wish to be jingoistic racist propaganda. So it wants to show you, hey, by the way, there were good Iranians as well. And you find out later that Sahar is protecting U.S. interests at great personal cost to herself. So that's kind of what it felt like to me. I don't think it really succeeds, but I kind of understand why they were doing it, you know?
Yeah, I actually just wish there were, it wasn't just like one person had to stand in for all of Iran, you know?
Yes.
What I mean? Like,
that would be great.
That would be nice.
Yeah. So in real life, the Taylors did have a housekeeper named Lolita who knew the truth about the diplomats and kept the secret. But Mark Lijak says that John Sheardown's garbage man was the person they had to avoid. He was a member of the local neighborhood watch, which was known as the Comité, or Farsi for committee. Here's Mark.
In addition to the gardener, John's garbage man was a member of the local comité. And whenever he would find a bottle of empty liquor bottle in the garbage, he would come to John and demand a full one for himself as a bribe. And John also was concerned that the increase in the quantity of garbage from having two people living in the house to six would trigger curiosity on the part of this guy as well. And it was curiosity he didn't want. So he started taking garbage to work with him and tossing it out the window as he'd drive by the local comité headquarters.
We do see the cooped up diplomats drinking a lot in what is supposed to be a dry country, but apparently that's all there was to do. Meanwhile, Tony, John, and Lester are looking through screenplays for a good script, or maybe just a really bad script. Jack O'Donnell gives Tony 6 hours to get something together, giving us a ticking clock that maybe isn't all that necessary. Tony finds gold in the script of Argo, a cheap Star Wars ripoff. In real life, Argo is a retreatment of an adaptation of a sci-fi book called Lord of Light. But guess who did the concept art?
Who did the concept art, Joanna?
Jack Kirby, legendary comic book artist, inventor of Captain America. Here's journalist Matt Baglia with more information about the script.
So Chambers has a script based off of a Roger Zelazny novel called Lord of Light. And a famous comic book artist, Jack Kirby, has done the illustrations already. The financing has fallen through. The movie's in turnaround, as they say. It's not being done. And that's when Chambers sort of wryly suggested, let's use Argo. And they realized that it also has a kind of, you know, mythical connotation. Jason and the Argonauts, it's the ship that the Argonauts sailed on. And Tiny says, this is perfect. So they have now a script. They have a title for the script.
So in the movie, the fake movie studio comes up with a fantastic poster for Argo and starts running it in magazines. And they really want to sell it as a real production. So they set up an office for the production company named Studio 6 for the Six Diplomats. But they think it's not enough. So they do a press release and announce a table read with some of the art.
As a member of the media, really quickly, I just want to say I both resent and agree with their statement when they're like, when you want to get the message out there, get the media to do it for you. And I was like, oh, that is what happens all the time. Anyway.
Well, also, I mean, the movie also seems to be saying like that it's very easy to trick the media into doing something.
Maybe if it's the 80s and it's Variety, poor Variety, they get dragged through the mud a little bit in this. Okay. So they really get a ton of people in costume come down to do the table read. And this is amazing. This is at this scene takes place at the Beverly Hilton, which is a place that I have to go to a lot for work. And it's really fun to see the Beverly Hilton as it looks like now, but with like a bunch of people in these crazy costumes. The Hollywood press comes down to ask questions, but Lester can't answer anything about the film. We're also introduced to the catchphrase, the unofficial catchphrase of the film, Argo, fuck yourself. Which apparently was something they actually said to each other throughout this process. Actually, I'm comforted to know that because it's repeated so many times that I'm like, what is happening? Yeah. But if it was real, I'm into it. All right. So anyway, it's a good way to break the tension of such a serious mission.
So we see like this extravagant waste of time and money, which like is already extravagant in normal circumstances, even more extravagant given that the movie is not even real. This is an interesting section of the movie, Joanna, because it kind of cuts between this ridiculous table read and also very serious like news footage of the hostage crisis. And I'm curious like if you had any thoughts about why they did it that way, because there's a few ways to read it, right? One is that like, hey, this extremely silly thing is going to try to help save this other thing, you know, the very simple plot driven way of reading it. Another way of reading it is that like these are both things that are put on for like mass consumption, right? That in some way he's indicating, maybe he being the filmmakers are indicating that like what Iran was doing and these revolutionaries were doing was like they were playing this drama out on a world stage to generate sympathy and achieve their ends. But it's a little bit opaque. I wasn't 100% clear on what they were trying to do. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So this part where they're doing these sort of, they march everyone to the basement and they do this sort of like fake execution just to scare them, which is based in reality. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. I didn't know if he was trying to draw a line between like the pageantry of that, like this sort of like faked, because in the end, I mean, not to spoil things for everyone, but like none of the hostages died in the hostage crisis. So you're like, what are they doing with them for over a year? And some of the stuff that, you know, some of the stuff was actually quite physically violent, but a lot of it was mental torture. And a lot of that mental torture comes from like theater, you know, like you know, and so I think a more sophisticated filmmaker, no huge knock on Ben Affleck, but I think a more sophisticated filmmaker could have drawn a really interesting line between theater of terrorism and this theater that's taking place in Hollywood. But unfortunately, I think because of the like comedic zany tone that they're trying to strike in this Beverly Hilton sequence, it just seems like a mismatch entirely. You know?
It felt very weird to me watching it.
Yeah.
I was thinking like, I think I know what you're trying to do, but I wasn't sure. And it just felt odd rewatching it again. So anyway, as you said, we get a very chilling scene where some of the hostages are marched into a basement and given mock executions. And unfortunately, it seems like this was actually part of the conditions in the embassy during the hostage crisis. Journalist Robin Wright and one of the six diplomats, Mark Lijek, tell a little bit about what was going on. First, you're going to hear from Robin Wright.
The hostages were tools of Iranian diplomacy. and they were used as both the carrot and the stick. There were sometimes they'd be paraded out in front with blindfolds, and there were other moments where they would be shown having, you know, a holiday dinner together to try to say we're taking care of them.
Also, to show solidarity with oppressed minorities, the Ayatollah actually released 13 hostages, all women and black people, on Thanksgiving. And in this next clip, Mark Lijek explains what the 13 hostages that were released, what insight they are able to give on hostage conditions overall.
We really had no way of knowing how the hostages were being treated. We assumed not well, but when those 13 made it to the States and they were able to talk to the media, they revealed some pretty horrifying things: mock executions, lack of food, isolation, beatings. They were treating, especially the Marines, were being treated badly. And we had to assume that this was typical of what the others were experiencing. So, of course, that was very depressing news for us.
So in the movie, the time finally has come to implement the plan. Jack drives Tony to the airport, where he takes off his wedding ring dramatically. Jack reminds him if he's captured, he's on his own, and they lightheartedly joke about Tony being executed if he is caught. Tony calls his son to say goodbye, but no one picks up, so instead he writes a letter. He also tells Lester and John Chambers to always have the studio phone manned in case someone calls.
Meanwhile, the six diplomats are more than a little stir crazy. Joe Stafford, the only diplomat we see have a personality, played by Scoot McNairy, is upset with himself for making his wife move with him to Iran. But don't worry, because Ken Taylor, played by Victor Garber, tells them they're getting a visitor soon. The CIA is finally coming for them. The ride to the airport! Your Lyft is on its way! Six diplomats. So what a journey through war-torn Iran and Hollywood glamour. Dave Chen, what do we have to look forward to in part two?
So Tony finally comes to Iran to rescue the six diplomats, but will they go along with the plan? The clock is ticking because both the Iranian revolutionaries and the CIA are going to turn against them. And I hope you like car chases, because we're going to get some version of one of those. In any case, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Truth vs. Hollywood. Thanks so much for listening. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, and it's hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. You can find me over at Culturally Relevant at culturallyrelevantshow.com. It's a podcast where I interview filmmakers and artists every week. And also the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where I talk about movies on a weekly basis.
You can find me talking about films, award season films, it's Emmy season time, all that kind of stuff on Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast. Also, I will be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast.
Feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. It would help this podcast to stand out amidst the crowd. Thanks for listening. Until next time, stay truthful.